You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The President Obama went outside the chain of command. He didn't use the NSA, he didn't use the CIA, he didn't use the FBI, and he didn't use the Department of Justice. He used GCHQ.
No, he didn't. The UK gives short shrift to the White House regarding claims that British intelligence had a hand in the still strangely unconfirmed wiretapping of Trump Tower. And US President Donald Trump meets German Chancellor Angela Merkel. But will the leader of the free world have got what she wanted from her visit to Washington?
Send a good picture back to Germany, please. Make sure.
My guests Marcus Hippie and Daniel Giacopelli will be here to discuss those and the day's other big stories, including Rex Tillerson's visit to the DMZ. Can there really be any understanding between a regime led by a volatile demagogue with weird hair and North Korea? We'll find out why London's only daily newspaper has named as its new editor someone with almost no journalistic experience, at least three other jobs, and a home 200 miles outside the capital. All that, plus the first and likely last live-action board game ever broadcast on Monocle 24. That's all coming up on Midori House right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniel Giacopelli, producer, presenter for Monocle 24, and Marcus Hippie, ditto. Welcome both. We will begin in the United States, the government of which has today found itself in the peculiar position of having to reassure the government of its most trusted ally that it will desist from repeating deranged fantasies that the UK's Communications Intelligence Service, GCHQ, spied on then-President-elect Donald Trump at the behest of then-President Barack Obama. In an unusual move for the usually militantly taciturn spooks, GCHQ issued a statement dismissing the charge as nonsense and, for good measure, utterly ridiculous. Danny, again speaking on behalf of your great nation, we come now to the end of week nine of the Trump administration. Where does this rate on the scale of the fiascos, scandals, shambles as we have already witnessed?
Well, the thing when you dispense with nonsense time and time again is that each successive bit of nonsense is slightly less important. I mean, I don't know. I mean, the fact that he pissed off an ally of the U.S. is pretty damaging. You know, people have said it's complete garbage, it's rubbish. The U.K. was pretty peeved off. But we've also, we meaning the collective, we have pissed off the Australians. We've pissed off many number of allies.
I thought he was doing it alphabetically for a while there. I was actually thinking by about now he'd be working his way up to about Yemen.
Yeah. I mean, we'll forget about this in a week.
I think this is going to be a pretty memorable week in the future. I'm just thinking about it's quite rare that you have an intelligence agency coming out in public having to comment on news that are taking place to be that
this is not true.
That is very rare.
Their usual line is won't confirm, won't deny. But this also comes in the same week in which we've seen the House Intelligence Committee in the United States, which is, of course, chaired by Republicans, actually coming out and saying we cannot stand up this Trump Tower wiretapping story.
Exactly. It would be really interesting to see what actually is going on behind the scenes. Where do these ideas come from, and how do people around Donald Trump actually feel about all this thing that's going on? They have been saying, we've got this message from the US that US will not repeat these claims, but at the same time, I'm wondering if they have been thinking about maybe phrasing that differently, considering that that is not exactly an apology. It's not exactly they're not admitting that actually that would not be true at all. They're just saying that they won't be repeating these claims.
Well, just completely ridiculous. I mean, Spicer stands up there with a line from Judge Andrew Napolitano, who's one of these kind of like, I don't want to say crackpots, but kind of crackpots, the Fox News brings out to kind of, he's like their go-to pundit. And he just says this stuff, which has zero, foundation whatsoever in truth, in reality.
But this is one of the many aspects of this whole thing that is repeatedly blowing my mind. I mean, there are some people for whom you can kind of understand and make excuses as to why they're watching Fox News or reading Breitbart and thinking much of this has any basis in verifiable reality. But if you are the president of the United States, you presumably have, you know, access to the really good stuff. You don't actually have to rely on dingbat conspiracies promoted by the internet and cable news.
Yeah, that's why this is all for show. And also remember, Sean Spicer is kind of up against the wall here. He knows this is complete BS. I mean, of course he does. He's not a dim-witted man. I mean, he knows he's trying to represent his boss, which is the president. He's probably emailing him every 5 seconds saying, back me up on this claim that I made. And this is them grasping at straws, trying to find any evidence whatsoever that what he said about wiretapping was correct.
Can you imagine if you worked for a business and the head of that business would just be, you know, obsessed about accusing other people for doing things they actually haven't necessarily done? How would you feel about that as an employee trying to represent someone?
It would be exhausting. I mean, I don't have any great amount of sympathy for the people who are choosing to work for this administration, but you have to think this got to get to a point at which it would just be, I mean, genuinely incredibly debilitating.
And imagine being in the UK government or now seeing this. I mean, there's a really good, there's a tweet flying around from General Michael Hayden's memoir, and he was, of course, the former director of the NSA. And he wrote that essentially, in the event of a catastrophe, all of the collection of signals intelligence of the US would be done by GCHQ. They essentially entrusted the collection of intelligence to the Brits. That's how close NSA and GCHQ are. I mean, this is like a really strong ally, the strongest of allies. And you're with one statement at a press conference, you're just completely throwing them under the bus.
And I think what I see in the future is that it's going to be harder for Donald Trump to actually find people who are willing to work with him. There was some speculation earlier that Sean Spicer would have to go and, well, who would want to replace him, essentially, trying to clarify what Donald Trump has said?
We should talk about the meeting today between President Trump and Chancellor Merkel. We don't know much about what they discussed, Danny. We have some footage. How would you say it seems to have gone based on that?
Well, I saw footage of the press pool in which they're sitting in the, I think it's the Oval Office in the White House, extremely awkwardly for about a minute and a half while people take photos. And they're just sitting there with kind of awkward looks on their faces. And at some point, a minute in, somebody's like, handshake! Because, of course, we know Trump, has this handshake war of attrition with visiting world leaders. And Merkel leans into Trump and says, handshake? And Trump just pretends he doesn't hear and just stares out ahead.
I mean, he's getting on
with
it.
It's very weird.
He might not have heard her.
Well, we heard it. I mean, yeah, maybe not. It's just very odd. It's very odd.
One handshake has been seen anyway, and that handshake was very different from the one we saw with Shinzo Abe when it looked like Donald Trump was about to rip his hand off.
Well, but in terms of like the actual content of what they talked about, you know, they disagree on pretty much every single thing you could imagine: immigration, NATO, the EU, trade, completely polar opposite leadership styles. I would love to be a fly on the wall in their meeting.
At the same time, it's extremely important that these two world leaders get along well. We're talking about the biggest European economy and the biggest economy in the world, the leaders meeting. And there has to be, looking at where the world is going and what is happening at the moment, it is important that there is some kind of agreement in some things even. I've been trying to think what Merkel would actually want to accomplish over there. It's not going to happen that Donald Trump is going to change his views publicly about what the role of NATO would be or how he feels about world trade and so forth. But even if Merkel could create a bit of understanding, some kind of a working relationship with the US, that would be a victory already.
I mean, is that, do you think, what she would have gone in there looking for, Danny? At least something they can agree on, something that you can build some sort of relationship on?
Yeah, I mean, well, Merkel sent a delegation to Washington, actually, early on to try to kind of, like, pave the way to test out, you know, what the Trump administration thinks about all this stuff. You know, I was at the Munich Security Conference a couple weeks ago, and Mike Pence was there. And this was the first real major foreign policy speech of the Trump administration. And Pence came out and said, to a certain amount of applause, you know, I believe in a strong NATO. I believe in a strong Europe. You guys are our strongest allies. It was kind of a reassuring speech. But nobody really knows who's calling shots on Europe. You know, Trump hated NATO before he liked NATO, so who knows what he's going to say next.
Okay, well, let's move along somewhat to further American diplomacy news. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, in a visit to South Korea, has said that the United States' policy of, quote, strategic patience, unquote, vis-a-vis North Korea may have to be rethought to the extent of taking preemptive military action if necessary. Happy as ever to help, President Trump thundered via Twitter that North Korea is behaving very badly, with which, in fairness, few would argue, but that China has done little to help, with which some, specifically China, you would think would take issue. Danny, if Tillerson is saying military option was on the table, is that really that big a deal? I mean, it's not like it's ever really been off the table, is it?
No, it's never been off the table. I mean, if North Korea ended up developing their ICBM and they tested one across the Pacific, then we'd shoot it down. I don't think the Obama administration ever explicitly said, you know, we're going to bomb missile sites in North Korea, although I'd have to check that. But, I mean, it's never been threatened as such. I mean, this whole strategic patience thing, let's wind the clock back to 2009, and I know a lot of people probably wish we could do that. but at the start of Obama's first term, a lot of people thought the U.S. might go for direct talks with North Korea, kind of shake up the status quo of, like, the standoff that's happened for decades. But then Pyongyang decided to do a nuclear test and a rocket launch, and that screwed up the whole plan. And then we saw the UN pass a resolution condemning the tests. But Clinton, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, the strategic patience was her thing. And it was the idea that North Korea's constant aggression would basically make them isolated, make them realize that they need to kind of denuclearize. And this is what Tillerson's saying is now, essentially, we can't wait them out anymore.
Marcus, if action against North Korea does become necessary at some point in the next few years, and a lot of very serious people think that's far from impossible, how much harder does it make it to organize a coherent response or coherent action when Donald Trump is president, when even his own country's allies don't know what he's talking about from one second to the next?
I think that's going to be something that anyone who is going to be collaborating in that effort with the US has to think. That man doesn't really seem to have that much of logic, does he? I think countries will have to get together and try to do what they can, but I think they still have to be a bit wary about the US actions and what is actually the thinking in Donald Trump's mind and what's actually happening in the White House.
Because remember, Donald Trump a long time ago said he'd be willing to have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un.
There's any number of reasons to suspect that Kim Jong-un would welcome that offer.
I mean, when I was in Munich at the security conference, I talked with Ian Bremmer from the Eurasia Group, and he said, kind of counterintuitively, if there's one guy who might be able to have a deal here, it's Donald Trump, because he has no real ideology. I mean, all he wants is North Korea to not have nukes. He doesn't care about human rights abuses.
But this was always the incredibly Pollyanna-ish, optimistic view of what a Trump presidency would be like. That he is a pragmatic, verging on amoral deal maker who just wants to get stuff done and doesn't really care about being right or wrong.
I think if something happens, I think an important thing to remember is how Donald Trump has been talking about China and what kind of relations he's been trying to build with Beijing.
But Danny, this is, though, on further on this note, this is the one thing we have not yet faced after 9 weeks. So far, every crisis, scandal, uproar, etc., has largely been of Trump's own creation. Do we have any idea yet of how he will respond as, you know, leader when something serious actually occurs?
No. I mean, the closest we saw was a couple of weeks ago, I think February 12th, when North Korea tested a missile when Trump was at Mar-a-Lago with Shinzo Abe. And of course, they huddled in the canteen of Mar-a-Lago while everybody was snapping photos. You know, at some point in the next coming years, North Korea is going to test an ICBM. They said in January that they were on the verge of testing one. We know that they are developing one. They just tested four, not ICBMs, but four missiles a couple weeks ago. It's going to happen at some point. And at that point, the question is whether or not you think Kim Jong-un is crazy enough to do it. And I don't think he's particularly crazy. I don't abide by that school of thought. I think he's a rational actor. And he knows that the nuclear weapons in North Korea is the only bargaining chip he has to make his country survive. I don't think he's a crazy guy. Trump might be crazy.
Well, on that thought, Marcus, even if Kim Jong-un is, as Danny says, a rational actor, and again, it's always fun trying to be optimistic about Trump, is it possible that the fact that the White House is now occupied by a volatile, unpredictable figure, might that actually make North Korea more minded to stay in their box somewhat? Because beforehand, they knew the rest of the world didn't like them, but they could usually predict with, you know, reasonable certainty how the world would respond to anything they did.
I think that's a good question. I think that's a good point. When you look at the language world leaders use, you always know what the logic is behind what will actually happen, or are they just saying that? And so far, when we've been, say, talking about Barack Obama and so forth, you've known that what he says, you know, what it actually means. So far, North Korea has been on quite in a safe place, considering what has been said about their nuclear program and what the future may be like. But now, Donald Trump is unpredictable. And I think Pyongyang will have to think about that there actually is a chance that there can be a preemptive strike if they actually don't start rethinking about what they're doing over there.
I mean, this is famously Richard Nixon.
Nixon
thing, right?
In Vietnam, the madman theory. Madman theory, yes.
Yeah, where Nixon wasn't a madman, but his whole thing was he wanted to pretend to be a madman to throw leaders off balance so they wouldn't know how he would react. Now, again, Trump may or may not be an actual madman. Nobody really knows. I mean, but that might give Kim Jong-un pause a bit before he does something crazy.
I guess in some situations, being unpredictable is a good thing.
But also remember, Trump's now kind of surrounded by relatively seasoned generals who would do their very best to make sure nothing crazy happens. He does have some less predictable advisors, but I mean, at least you have McMaster, you have Mattis, you have some good guys in there, so who the hell knows, Andrew? Mm-hmm.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniel Giacopelli and Marcus Hippie. Coming up next, in a surprise move, London's Evening Standard names as its new editor someone who hasn't worked in journalism since getting knocked back by The Times 20 years ago.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Susan Goldberg.
There is nothing more thrilling than creating an atmosphere where people can tell the very, very best stories that make a difference in communities.
National Geographic's editor-in-chief sits down with Monocle's Thomas Lewis in Washington, D.C. to discuss some implications of the U.S.'s new government, the role of women in media, what makes a good cover, and how to steer a legacy brand through changing times.
We are all about the facts, and we will follow where the science takes us and where the reporting takes us, and that's what makes us strong, that's what makes us distinctive, and that's got to be our position in the market.
The Big Interview with Susan Goldberg premieres this Sunday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Monocle 24's Marcus Hippie and Daniel Giacopelli. Now, former UK Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne was already a busy man. A fund manager at BlackRock, star turn with the Washington Speakers Bureau, Kissinger Fellow at the University of Arizona, and when he had absolutely nothing more pressing to do, Member of Parliament for Tatton. He will now also have to find the time to edit London's Evening Standard, a daily newspaper covering a beat further from his constituency than London is from Brussels. Marcus, there has been a certain amount of slapped foreheads and exclamations of gadzooks echoing around the London media universe today. Is there any way this isn't as mad as it sounds?
I don't know. It is obviously mad, but at the same time, I see a certain logic over there. Have you been looking at journalism job ads recently? What they're looking for are...
Have
you, Marcus? Should we be knowing something?
Are incredibly driven, amazingly well-networked individuals who've seen a lot of world and know how things work. And actually, when you think of the experience this guy has actually got during his career, he knows a lot of people, he knows a lot of influential people, and he can probably get quite a few things organised if he just makes a couple of phone calls. I see that side. At the same time, I see a number of issues over here, and
like the fact that he has no previous experience in anything. However,
there is a logic, because
example.
That has been a long time dream for him. It seems there are reports.
Well, it's been
that
a long time dream of mine to play at centre half forward for Geelong and bat number five for Australia. But there are good reasons why that's not happening.
Ever since he graduated from Oxford University, he was trying to get a job in media in the beginning. He was shortlisted for intern places for the Times, but he didn't get a place. And after that, he did a bit of freelance.
It's difficult
work.
To get on the ladder of
and
journalism, Marcus.
After politics, he all of a sudden becomes the editor of one of the most read newspapers in the United Kingdom.
It's nice to think that people regard senior cabinet office as a kind of plan B after failing to get into journalism.
And also, I think it's always interesting. It's actually slightly annoying as well that so many people think that they can just become journalists without any experience or any training. And I think this is a great example.
Okay, let's turn this around on Marcus. Marcus, share your CV with the world.
Oh, I am educated. I've done a lot of stuff, and I am here.
No, the funny thing is, if you see Osborne, what he said, the paper's edited in the morning and Parliament votes in the afternoon. Oh, there we go.
I mean, talking about these issues, also look at the role of media. The job of the media is to keep an eye on those who are in power and criticise them if needed. You have a Tory MP heading this newspaper.
Because
How is it going to work?
We should stress that, he is stating his intent to remain in office.
Which is completely bonkers.
Representing a constituency 200 miles away from London while he edits London's Metro Daily newspaper.
And he's getting paid presumably a full-time salary of £74,000 a year as an MP.
Which he would barely notice.
Yeah, true.
In fairness.
But the thing is, George Osborne has six jobs.
It's hard to imagine he's actually going to be the actual hands-on day-in, day-in-out editor. I suspect this is sort of a full-time guest editor's position. And, you know, he can use it to launch himself as a Remain Conservative against the current Conservative government. He can position himself for a tilt at the mayoralty in 2020. But what's in this for the Evening Standard?
I was just going to ask you that same question.
Oh, good.
I don't know. I can't. I mean, it's been the press since it was announced has been overwhelmingly negative. I mean, it surely couldn't have been a PR thing for them, good PR. I don't know. Marcus, what do you think?
Maybe there were just some board members who were going through all these CVs and they weren't particularly excited, and then there was one job application from Osborne. I don't know. I'm wondering about that. What I'm also wondering is that if anyone's been thinking in the offices of the Evening Standard about if there's going to be a backlash. Actually, I have to admit, I do read London Evening Standard. That's only because I travel to work underground and it's free and you get it there
every day. We should make that clear to non-London listeners. It's quite backlash proof in that respect, in that it's free.
And I read it too. I mean, I like the Evening Standard because it's where let me rewind a bit. I don't own a TV. So I get my London news primarily from reading the Evening Standard and the Metro in the morning.
Thank you, Danny, there for terrific confirmation of the old joke about how you know when someone hasn't got a television.
Oh, yeah.
They'll tell you.
I think it's also interesting that I think my relationship with that newspaper is going to change. Coming from Finland, we take pride from newspapers actually not having public opinions, and the situation in the UK is a bit different. Newspapers are a bit biased often, that you know what they stand for. London Evening Standard, so far when I've been reading it, I've never really thought about it. I've been just thinking that it's quite neutral. And all of a sudden, when they choose someone like Osborne to charge
the newspaper,
they're
extremely neutral. If you look at their opinions pages, it's pretty much exactly down the middle of what you think they're going to say. It's kind of, they stand up for common sense issues. I mean, there's no real political agenda. What do you think, Andrew?
I guess I'm thinking about the brand now.
I think it's fairly easy to characterize its general sensibility as somewhat right of center. I mean, not militantly and not sort of headbangingly or foaming at the mouthingly, but, you know, it says something, I think, about the ambitions of its proprietor, really, that this follows last year's much mocked decision to award their apparently coveted Londoner of the Decade title to Prince Charles, who, again, I'm not sure actually lives in London.
This is a fun game. Who would you guys choose for Londoner of the Decade?
Guys, this is getting us dangerously off topic. We have a big finale.
I was wondering which other politicians you would like to see heading newspapers in
this
country.
It's not unheard of. Boris Johnson edited The Spectator. Geoffrey Robinson owned The New Statesman while he was an MP. Michael Foot was editor of The Evening Standard before becoming an MP. I think Bill Deeds, was he editor of The Telegraph after or before? I mean, there is coming and going.
But could you imagine if, like, John McCain was the editor of The New York Times?
No, it's absurd. I mean, I do think... I mean, trying to do both at once is faintly ridiculous. But we must allot time for our grandstand finish this evening, because we are going to regale our listeners with a pioneering moment in broadcasting, what may be and arguably should be the first ever live on radio board game. We are indebted to Politico, who have designed the Brexit board game. It is, if we're honest, clearly a cartoon freighting satirical intent, but we're going to play it literally, equipped with dice purchased especially for this great event, liquid producing there by Tom Hall, plus a cactus, a promotional Jameson shot glass in honour of St. Patrick's Day, and Marcus's stapler. These will be serving as the counters. Who's going to be what?
We should state at the beginning, you have to choose whether you're a hard Brexit or a soft Brexit.
Yeah, I'm revealing my colours as a latte slurping metropolitan liberal and going soft Brexit.
I'd like to go for soft as well, so Danny, you have to be the one who goes for hard.
Danny, you're going to have to be the Ayn Rand reading American libertarian crank here.
Okay, let's do it.
So who's going to...
Us out of this terrible union.
Who's going to be what item?
I'm a cactus.
I can be the stapler.
Okay, so that means I'm going to be the Jameson's shot glass. Okay, we even got a wooden board, so the dice rattle. Are we going to use two dice or one? It's a very short thing. I think two dice is going to be overdoing it.
I think let's do one.
Okay, so okay, we'll start.
So Marcus, kick it off.
You can go first, Marcus.
That is one.
Marcus gets a one.
What does he say there?
It says Boris Johnson insults Angela Merkel. You're soft Brexit, right? So you go back one.
Okay.
So if you're a hard,
that's
so
not
you're,
very good,
you're back in the beginning.
You're,
back,
you're literally back at square one. So we'll go anti-clockwise. So I'll,
if only we had a webcam.
Oh, I'm grateful every day that we don't.
I can't contain
all right,
my excitement.
Andrew has two.
Seriously, if anyone ever wants to get rid of me and can't figure out how to tell me, just install webcams.
You get an espresso break.
Espresso break. Okay, I don't have to do anything.
So metropolitan of you.
Well, exactly. Latte break.
So soft Brexit
really
of you. Marcus, do you want to roll for me?
That's very hard
six?
Brexit of you, Danny.
Okay.
Getting other people
bringing
to roll
the cactus.
Your dice for
one,
you.
Two, three, four, five, six. Roll again.
Wow.
This is going badly. The hard Brexit.
This is golden one. Radio. One. What does that say, Andrew?
I can't read in this light. Hang on. It's something about Brexit Irish.
No, it's about the debate over where to hold the negotiation. So the UK would like to keep the EU negotiations.
If anybody at Politico
in South
is
London,
listening to this, please don't print things in black writing on blue type.
Yeah, this says. Compromise on Brexit talks location, Irish pub in Stockholm.
Okay, fine. So do you go ahead or backwards?
Move forward too.
Danny's killing this.
Six. One, two, three, four, five, six. Roll again.
No.
Six.
This is going
well,
badly.
Leading. One, two, three, four,
I think we're
five,
possibly
six.
Killing the journalism medium single-handedly.
Boris Johnson insults the French.
Again?
I need to go back, don't I?
Yeah, probably.
A few. Yeah, I'm there.
Descending into anarchy, Marcus.
It is. That stapler is taking up far too much space as well. This is going badly. Okay, I can't read that because it's black on blue again.
What does that say?
It's something about Brexit and London.
Is this the future of media, by the way?
Is this the future of games? It says, EU refuses to hold Brexit talks in London.
How is this holding up, chaps, against your own particular favourite board games, do you think?
You know what? I prefer Risk. I'm more of a risk man myself.
Marcus?
I am obsessed about Trivial Pursuit. The
really?
Finnish version in particular.
Well, I mean, we should do that next week. We should play the Finnish version.
Is there a Finnish version of Trivial Pursuit?
There is a Finnish version,
what are the
obviously.
Questions
there are different
are
versions for all countries.
How many polar bears can you fit in a sauna?
Are the questions all about moose?
Yeah, reindeer as well. And
Is there a separate moose and reindeer section?
I think the last question I answered was about this news story that someone claims to have seen a lion in the forests in eastern Finland. The question was, which year was that? That was 1994.
That's a question.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Giacopelli, Marcus Hippie, thank you both very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephen Kenny. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next at 1900. Marcus is back with the menu. More on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.